From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us. Today we're talking about addiction recovery. And we're talking with Keith Leese and Michael Castle. They're going to be our guests today. And we'll talk about resources that are available locally. We'll talk about how to recognize whether you might be or someone you love might be in the throes of behavior that isn't the greatest for them, and where they can turn for help. But first, let me officially welcome our guests. Keith Leese is the program chair for human services at Western Technical College and has a wide array of experiences related to addiction recovery from an academic perspective and also from a personal perspective as well. Keith, thank you very much for joining me today.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Looking forward to the conversation.
We're talking also to Michael Castle, who is an area resident who himself has experience on the personal level with addiction recovery, and I am very grateful for his willingness to share his story with us today. Michael, welcome to Newsmakers.
Thanks for having me.
I want to get, as soon as I can, I want to dive into some personal stories, because I think that's what people relate to the best. But Keith, let's just set the table first. People hear terms thrown around all the time, like addiction and recovery, and drug abuse or alcohol abuse, or some might hear a softer term used, like alcohol use disorder versus abuse or something like that. What goes into choices about what language is used when, in terms of abuse, misuse, addiction, those kinds of words?
Yeah, so oftentimes it's personal preference. When we do get into the medical field and insurance and billable, then there are distinctions between substance use, you know, cannabis use disorder, alcohol use disorder, cocaine use disorder, mild, moderate, severe. So those are clinical terms that get used in that setting. But outside of that, it really is kind of a matter of personal choice. I do think the term addiction gets thrown around a lot, kind of loosey-goosey, but, you know, it's really a matter of personal choice and what people, you know, are used to saying or want to say.
Is there terminology that is like just no longer used, or a terminology that's just not helpful?
I'm sure that there are terms, you know, that people have different feelings on, you know, I'm a person in long-term recovery versus I'm a drug addict and my name is, you know, so there are personal preferences there. You know, I prefer to introduce myself as a person in long-term recovery. And for me, that means, you know, that I haven't used a substance stronger than caffeine in a little over 17 years. So I feel like that emphasizes recovery more than the sickness. And so that's my preference, but I'm not the sole owner of that.
Okay. Michael, I'm interested to learn more about you. I know you're here to share some of your personal experiences with us. Tell me about how you began to realize that you needed help.
Well, I'm 56 years old, and when I was about 16, that was about the first time I started having issues, where using was becoming a problem. And, I recall being kind of, I think it's called chaptered. Or when you're that young, you can just get kind of sent to a psych unit. And I went to a psychiatric unit, and I spent maybe a month or more there, but it didn't really stick. But I recall, you know, thankfully at the time, my parents were really trying to just reach out and do the best they could. And after I got out of that treatment, I did a summer in the Smoky Mountains at like an adventure camp. And, you know, I stayed abstinent for a while, but, I, you know, like a lot of people, you just fall into a group of, young people that are, you know, similar minded and maybe not interested in abstinence, and so I started using again. And I mean, I learned at a, you know, I don't have, that was be 1983. I don't have 40 years clean. I did celebrate 25 years a couple weeks ago, but in those interim years of those 15 years, I struggled with just, you know, just the downward spiral of using, and kind of the nightmarish existence that can come with that.
Did you have a particular substance that you were most drawn to, or was it a mixed bag?
Kind of a mixed bag, whatever was, you know, I had the money for, but definitely a mixed bag, you know, whatever was around that I could afford. And probably in the culture I live in and affordability, you know, for me, it was a lot of times alcohol. But yeah, so, I mean, when did I, you know, fully concede that I had a problem? I'm really thankful about I mentioned 25 years ago. You know, Keith mentioned that, you know, it being an illness. And, I remember as a young boy, my dad going into the hospital because he had epilepsy, and, you know, he had kind of picked me up and dusted me off as a dad over many, many years, like many family members do. And 25 years ago, we did one of those family sessions, you know, you're in a hospital and you're doing group therapy and you're kind of on the hot seat. And he looked at me, and he, you know, I was about 30, 31, you know, and still struggling to try and figure out what, you know. Yeah. And he looked at me, said, you know, it's just like me, Michael. He says, I have a disease. And when I take my medicine, I don't have seizures. I don't end up in hospitals. And maybe at the moment, I didn't really want to hear it, you know, maybe because it's coming from dad. And, you know, there's just this knee jerk reaction to, oh, you know, that's just dad. But it really kind of, after a few weeks, it kind of stuck. It was like, yeah, you know, there's all this wellness and help being offered to me, and this is my medicine, you know. And by then at the hospital, they were encouraging me to find support groups and, you know, go to different meetings. And I started doing that. And I look at that as that I have a medical illness, and if left untreated, I end up where sick people go. And those places that I've gone or have been the psych wards, you know, living in my car, you know, dereliction and destitution, been in jails for, you know, DUIs and things like that, you know, and so that really changed my perspective more than anything. It wasn't like any doctor or anybody in any sort of 12-step group or anything like that. It was the person closest home to me. Because I remember as a kid going into the hospital and my dad, when the drugs weren't so good for epilepsy, and seeing him, he had had a grand mal seizure multiples, and it was like he had been hit by a hurricane. And it was like, when he said that, it was like, oh yeah, yeah, his drugs have gotten a lot better. When he takes his drugs, his epilepsy drugs, he hadn't had any kind of seizures like that in a long time. And so it's like, I take my medicine, and, you know, it changes over time. But, you know, I make abstinence an utmost priority in my life. And a part of that is making good choices in my life.
What was the first time that you were introduced to drugs or alcohol?
Oh, I don't know. I really don't know. It might have been just, you know, around family or friends, you know, hanging out with some friends in fifth or sixth grade, you know, and maybe they pilfered some cigarettes from mom or dad or a beer. And it was like, it felt devious and sneaky and very, I don't know, there was something exciting about it. And then one thing leads to another, and it's like, oh, a beer isn't quite enough. Okay, I heard about this stuff called marijuana. Okay, I'll try that. Oh, you know, you hear about psychedelics. Okay, you're gonna try some of that. And I with some friends of ours used to joke, but it's got honest truth. I didn't know about a lot of different drugs, and I remember, one of the police liaison came into our junior high and started telling us about the dangers of drugs and describing all these drugs and different effects of drugs, and we're like, oh, okay, well, maybe I'll go out and explore that. So maybe it helped some kids, but it did. There was a group of us that we got out of that session. It was like, I had no idea. We got to go find some of
So you were like adding those things to the queue.
that. Actually, yeah, yep.
Keith, what about your experience? Were you a young user like Michael?
My first experiences are, garage refrigerator with beer and parents' cigarettes and stuff like that. And it escalated pretty quickly. Even before I ever used a drug, I struggled with depression. Some of my first earliest memories are like climbing up scaffolding, to a building that was being built across the street from my house. And I don't remember why I went up there or what had happened, but I remember like hanging over the edge, crying, hoping, that wind would knock the scaffolding over and maybe I would break my neck. And so that was, I was suicidal. I don't remember what had happened, but that was long before I ever took a drug. So 8 or 9, and then I started using alcohol in sixth grade, summer after sixth grade year. So like I was 11 or so. Alcohol and weed. And it sounds weird to say, but I'm lucky in that I don't use chemicals well. So I went from like playing sports and being active, growing up, like every season was a different sport to, starting to use in sixth grade. And then by freshman year, I wasn't in any sports. I think I played a few practices of freshman football, but the only reason I even joined that was because I was on the an electronic monitor for being arrested for something I can't remember. And I wanted to get out of the house. And once they took the ankle bracelet off, and I could get out of the house and do other things, I just dropped the football team. So I went downhill pretty quickly, and ended up getting incarcerated, right after my freshman year, of high school for quite a while. And so it sounds weird, but because I was so bad at these things, the evidence that something was wrong and that I needed, when I got into recovery at 24 years old, I was either going to get into recovery or kill myself. It wasn't like I was doing it really well. I think the using was a result of kind of some self-medication, and it went downhill pretty quickly. And, at first it helped a lot. It really did. But then it made things way, way worse. And it snowballed on me pretty quickly.
How often do we see those two things going together, addiction and depression?
Maybe not necessarily just depression, but mental health. Data is varies widely on the actual numbers, but I think there might come a day where we see that everybody that struggles with addiction probably has some form of mild mental health, whether it's depression, anxiety, something, that's attached to that. It
Well, that makes
really
sense. When we
varies
think
widely.
about addiction, I mean the novices among us, like me, when we think about addiction, we think about it as a mental health condition. So it makes sense that a lot of those things might sort of be, like coexisting.
Yeah, those co-occurring disorders is what we call it, and it's pretty frequent. It's hard to we used to treat them separately, and we still do in some cases, which isn't great. You go to one person for substance abuse treatment and one person for mental health, but we know that if we can do them together, it's better, and we're really starting to move that way, as much as we can.
We're talking today with Keith Lease. He is a professor at Western Technical College in the Human Services Department. And is also a person in recovery from drug and alcohol abuse. Also talking with Michael Castle, who similarly is in recovery and is sharing his story with us today on Newsmakers. If you have a story you'd like to share, or if you have a question that you'd like us to pose in a future episode of this show, or would like to get in touch with us for any reason at all, you can always email. It's newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. Our program continues in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall at UW La Crosse in our southwestern Wisconsin studios. Thank you very much for joining us. We're talking to Michael Castle and Keith Lease today on Newsmakers about addiction recovery. We've heard a little bit about each of their stories. I want to circle back to Michael. Now, Michael, you said you had sort of a lot of stops and starts, starting with being put into a detention center when you were still a juvenile, in an environment where that wasn't really substance abuse treatment. It really was kind of incarceration. And then later on, ultimately finding a way to be clean now for quite a long time. What was it that finally clicked? I know we don't talk about these things as being permanent, like you're not over your addiction. At least most people don't talk about it that way. But what was it that finally helped you find success in that area?
Well, let me just clarify. Back when I was in 16, it was a locked unit. It was a psychiatric unit, but
okay.
It wasn't quite incarceration, but either way, I couldn't come and go freely. So I guess it was a level of incarceration.
It felt like incarceration. I got that detail. That's on me. I didn't clarify that point. No. So I apologize for that. And thank you for clearing that up.
Yeah, that was me, Ezra. I was incarcerated at 16.
I guess I can relate to Keith, though, how like as your using escalates, you drop those things that were vital to you as a youth. Like me, it was some sports. My whole family, we were all swimmers. We swam competitively. And by the time I was a freshman in high school, you know, I was swimming on the varsity team in Beloit, and we had a pretty solid swim team. And then, you know, using became more and more prevalent. And by the end of the season, I was just like, I'm done. So, I mean, we struggle like that and we get encouragement from family. But until, you know, like for me, it was I reached a level of desperation where it was like, I just can't do this anymore, you know. And I was out of ideas about what maybe I thought I didn't know how to live life anymore. Mine was. In August of 98, when that was really changed, was, I was very intoxicated and bounced off one car and put my car into a post office in Rockford. And I went from there to the county jail. And some people that have been incarcerated might know this, but in jail, there's not really any mirrors. And if they are, they're all scratched out because nobody wants to really look at themselves maybe. But so I didn't really get a look at myself in there. But after a few days, I went to a hospital for addicts and I saw my real physical self and I could see that I was dying and I was making that choice. I was a part of that choice. I mean, and thankfully I had a few days abstinent and I wasn't sure that I wanted to stop using, but the thing I wanted more was I wanted to live. And if I didn't, I knew that if I didn't stop using, my life expectancy was getting really short and I didn't know how to not use drugs. I had no idea how to do that anymore. I conceded that. And that can seem like a really pathetic place to be, like, because maybe some people don't know this, but the opportunity to be abstinent and get clean is always happening 24/7 every day. But the really kind of the cosmic collision for us in recovery is this, that collides with the desire. And I had an overwhelming desire that day, more than I had had in a long time, that I wanted to live. And that meant that I needed to not use. And thankfully, when I came to that realization, I was in a hospital for addicts. And they were toting me around to 12-step meetings and other support groups and helping me to take a look at myself and what had become of my life and what did I want it to look like. And it had been a really nightmarish existence, and I didn't want it to look like that anymore. And really, for the first time in a long time, I sincerely said, I want help. And that was about the same time where when my father shared with me, you know what, this is my medicine, you got your medicine. You know, when you go to those meetings and be a part of things, and you stay clean, you get well, you stay healthy. When you don't do that, you get sick and you end up where sick people go.
You're talking about that desire to live kind of outweighing the fact that you don't actually know how to not take drugs. But in your previous experiences where folks had tried to help you clean up or things that might have worked for a while and then didn't or whatever, was that desire to live less present there, or was it just that you were getting so bad at that point that you realized that it could actually impact the length of your life?
That was it. I mean, I realized that life was getting short for me. The other times when people tried to help me, it was like I could come up with some excuse or reason, bad luck. Maybe I made a momentary bad decision, but I'll do better next time, and that's just kind of a big lie.
Yeah, that idea that you're in control.
Yeah, I got this.
Yeah. Keith,
Yeah.
what about you? When did you start to turn the corner? I mean, you've got, what do you say, 17 years clean now?
Yeah, 17. I was at 16, I got incarcerated for an armed robbery, and it was actually a suicide by cop attempt. I walked into a convenience store with an empty shotgun and tried to get the police to kill me because I didn't want to live, but I was afraid to kill myself. And the drugs helped me kind of deal with that, but then also made it worse. I'm a very different person when I'm not drunk or high than when I am, and I do things that I regret, and I wake up and I feel that intimately in my soul. And so I got out after a couple years and went back kind of very similar to Michael, kind of in and out of things. And every time I went to see a counselor or a treatment or incarceration, like I learned a little bit every time. And I think I really do think like they all played a role in helping me so that when I was 24, I woke up on a floor in an apartment in a started to like kind of come to and remember all the things I had done the night before, and I just wanted to melt into that carpet. I was so filled with shame and guilt. And I thought, I either have to get clean or I'm going to kill myself. I just was that low. And I was able to kind of take a lot of the things that I learned from before and reach out and ask for help. And my older brother, is also in recovery, and he shares that openly. And I was lucky enough to have him and give him a call and be like, I need help, and he was like, I've been kind of waiting for this call for a lot of years. I'm proud of you. And he came and got me, and that really helped for me. But even then, like, I was so filled with shame and guilt, but I still liked the way that I felt when I was intoxicated. You know, I really tried for a long time to find a way to use successfully. And if I could have found that way to use without doing things that I regretted, I would still be using today. I would never have quit, but I just couldn't. You know, I'm an addict. I don't use chemicals well. Like, I can't use and not do things that I regret, no matter what I try.
What I want to ask you about that, because especially with alcohol, but now as society takes a different view at things like marijuana and maybe even some other things, there are people who can use a little bit on a moderated basis and then go back to regular life and remember everything that happened the night before and not get into situations. Like, is it, what are those feelings? Did you have any particular feelings of comparison between yourself and people who could do that? Or had you convinced yourself that there was a path to becoming one of those people?
Jealousy would be the main word, you know. You know, it's, I wish I could do those things, you know. And the reality is that drugs aren't inherently bad. How we use them are. And the other reality that goes along with that, and this is really important, not everybody can use, not everybody can drink socially. Like, it's not a given right. There are some people that we all know, like every one of your listeners can think of a few people who should just not get messed up, who should just not have that one beer. And I'm one of those people. And that was really hard to acknowledge about myself, because I love to go into ball games and, you know, drinking and picnics and, like, you know, going camping. And I loved all of that stuff. So I think there's a lot of people who can do that successfully. I'm not one of them.
Michael, what do you, I heard you kind of laugh in the background when Keith said that his first reaction is just to be jealous of people like that.
I accept that. Yeah, I'm not one of them. I don't struggle with that. I accept that there are some people that they can, you know, drink or, you know, smoke some weed or do whatever they do. And then the next, you know, they get up or they may go out and, you know, drink a beer, or they leave and there's half a beer, you know, on the table. It's like, what? That would be my, you know, like, I'm not one of them, and I don't struggle. I don't, like, oh, damn those people. Why do they, you know, like, well, you know, this, I have some, you know, you know, I'm born, you know, and came to be an adult of 6 feet tall. Like, I don't complain about the fact that I'm 6 feet tall or anything like that. It's just to me, it's just genetics. And I look at it as an allergy to things that intoxicate me. And, you know, when I get intoxicated, it not just becomes a thing I want to do, it becomes the thing I want to do most, more than anything. Mm-hmm.
You talked about it being genetics, but Keith, one of my questions that I wanted to ask is, what do we know about the causes of addiction? It can be genetic, but is it hereditary in the sense that we normally think of something being passed on from one generation to the next?
Yeah. So it's the nature nurture argument. And most of the research you look at is going to say 60-40, you know, percent one way or the other. We know addictions has genetic components to it. So genetics absolutely play a role. Those predispositions, they make us more sensitive to those things. Like, I tell my kids, our family really likes to drink, really likes drugs. We like it more than the average person, so we have to be really careful with that. But it's also important to know that genetics isn't destiny, right? So you can have somebody that comes from family with just everyone who struggles with addiction, and they won't, right? We see it in, like, the twin studies, right, where one will struggle with it and one will not. A lot of your listeners probably have siblings that have struggled with it, and they don't. So genetics isn't all of it, but it absolutely plays a role and can, you know, It shortens our experimental timeline, right? So some people can experiment throughout college and then they kind of just snap out of it. Some people with really strong genetic predispositions, alcohol is just as addictive as crack, right? The first time they try it, it's on, you know? And so it is not an equal, even playing field. Everybody is different, and mental health is included in that as well. So like if there's a lot of mental health that's in your genetic family, that can leave you more susceptible to a substance use disorder as well.
I saw recently, as I was preparing for this conversation, I happened to see on social media a viral video of a very small child, might not have even been 1 year old yet, reacting to her first taste of ice cream. And like when she got that bite like in her mouth, you could literally just see her eyes light up in a way that I would imagine they probably hadn't before. And that reminded me of how some people describe some of their experiences with drugs and alcohol. My question is though, how we're not all very self-aware people. How do we know if that's us? Like, how do I know when I take a drink, when I have an experience with a drug, how do I know if I'm one of those people that my mind is something about that is just so captivating that it's going to create a problem for me.
Yeah, that's a hard question to answer for everybody, because for some people it is that moment. Like I've heard stories, and Michael, I'm sure, has heard stories, you know, of people like the first time that they try it, it is like, this is what I have been looking for. And you know, they don't call that addiction, but like they might not be physically addicted to that drug after that first time, but psychologically, it's there right away. Other people, you know, it takes a little bit longer, and that's the challenge, is it can creep up really slowly for a lot of us. And in fact, there's a lot of people who probably struggle, you know, with substance use disorders, but they don't go to jail. They go to work every day, they pay their bills, and they don't ever, you know, get in domestic violence or anything like that. And so they think that they're okay, but every weekend, you know, they're going out and unwinding, and they're, you know, it's taking up a larger role. When I would work with clients when I was still doing counseling, I would have them for maybe 6 weeks, and I'd say, okay, let's just not use for 6 weeks. Not that you should never use again, but you know, so many people say I can quit anytime I want to, I just don't want to. Well, like let's try it for 6 weeks and see how easy or how difficult that is. And I would challenge everybody here to like, you know, take a break from it and see what that looks like. You know, for some people it will be really easy, and for others, it's going to be how they have fun and how they meet people and how they unwind. And they might not go to jail over it, but it might be playing a bigger role than they want it to be.
Well, if you've been listening to our conversation with Keith Leese and Michael Castle today, and it reminds you of either yourself or someone that you love, and you're wondering, what do I do next? Where do we go from here? We're going to talk about that as our program continues. You're listening to Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. If you've missed part of our conversation today and you want to hear it, you can find it on our website along with the rest of our episodes. You can listen to any number of our shows. Just go to wpr.org/newsmakers. That's wpr.org/newsmakers. Or just open your favorite podcasting app and type in WPR Newsmakers and search for us that way. We'd love to have you subscribe to the show as a podcast. Our conversation with Keith and Michael continues in just a moment right here on Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us. We're talking about addiction recovery today on Newsmakers. We're talking with Michael Castle, who's been sharing his personal experiences in recovery and what led to his recovery from from drug abuse and alcohol abuse. We've also been talking to Keith Lease, who's been sharing with us not only his perspective as a person in recovery, but also his perspective as a person who teaches this subject matter as part of his job as the program chair for human services at Western Technical College. Let's start with you, Michael. If this conversation is hitting a little bit too close to home for a listener, what do you think is a next step for them? Where would you advise them to turn next?
I think probably the first step is just to get honest with themselves about what they've been doing. Some of the things that were mentioned just a minute ago about, you know, the choices we're making. Maybe I noticed that, you know, I've been avoiding certain important family members or friends to allow myself to use and consume however it is I want to use my, you know, my drugs. And those are the kinds of things, because like life is the important thing in life is not things, it's the relationships we have. And the one that is the most important for really is with ourselves. That's where it starts. So taking a look at that, like, where am I at? Where am I going? Is this what I want my life to look like? You know, and how are my relationships, you know, with myself and my family members? It's either it's a spouse or parents. How are those right now? Are they healthy, or are they really strained and damaged? Those might be evidence. And just, you know, we live in a community that all we got to do is open our mouth and say, I need help. The hard part, you know, is being open to receive that. We open our mouth and say, I want help. There will be help that'll come.
Keith, to Michael's point about in a community like the greater La Crosse area, most of the places around here, I can think of a lot of resources that are available to people. Just being willing enough to admit that you need help. But for somebody who just doesn't know, like, to whom do they admit that? Like, is there, you know, I know we're not here to recommend any particular meeting or program or whatever over another, but like, if somebody just doesn't know who they should call, who's going to get them into whatever kind of help they need, who is that?
Yeah. So it's a wide range. There's a lot of help available from like support groups and things like that are free. And you can find support groups, mostly of the 12-step variety, in some of the smallest communities that we have in Wisconsin, right? The bigger the location, the more options that they're going to be. When it comes to if you're looking for kind of professional help, usually your general practitioner, if you've got one of those, is a good place to start. But if you don't even have a general practitioner, which a lot of us don't, one really helpful resource that covers 98% of the country is 211. And so if you dial 211 on your phone, you can get connected to a live person, or you can go online and they can start looking up resources in your area, both cost ones, you know, paid and unpaid. And that's not just for addictions, mental health, food insecurity, housing. 211 is a really, really great asset to use. In our La Crosse area, it's the Great Rivers 211, but every area, there's the Dane County 211. It's all across the country. So that's a really good resource to just reach out and be like, where can I go? You know, in La Crosse, we have the recovery community organizations like Cooley Recovery Center that you can walk into and be like, help, and 10 people will you know, come up to you and be like, you know, what do you need? Other places that are not quite as lucky, but that 211 is a good resource to help you find what's available in your area.
When people start thinking about maybe they drink too much, maybe they're on drugs and wouldn't like to be, you start thinking of everything from, as you mentioned, meetings, which can be free and which are in most communities, versus, you know, all the way the other end of the spectrum is some kind of residential program. How do you know what level of help you need, whether a meeting is going to be enough, whether you might need to see a therapist of some kind, or whether you need to go like live somewhere else for a while?
I think it's a very personal thing, and not everybody goes to meetings. Some people will go to their church. Some people will just stop. You know, that it's a very personalized thing. And so it's kind of experimentation. We don't talk about this a lot in the field, but the best psychiatrists, the best psychologists, the clinical social workers, the best therapists on the planet, they're still only guessing, right? There's no blood test to say, oh, you've got this level of addiction. And so Michael had mentioned, you know, getting honest. The more honest we can be with people when we reach out to help, the more accurate of an idea that they will get. Like, oh, this person drinks enough to where we really need to have them hospitalized to go through a medically monitored withdrawal, versus like, you know, somebody who might be addicted to cannabis, probably wouldn't need necessarily that level of care, no matter how bad it got, right? So it is a very personalized thing, just to start anywhere and kind of go from there. I think it's one of the reasons why some of our outcomes are as low as they are, is because, you know, we don't necessarily start off with the right level of care and aftercare.
Well, I want to ask both of you, we'll start with Michael. When now you've been in recovery for a long time and have stayed clean for a while, and yet I'm wondering, like, if there are things or stressors or triggers or things that you see when you're interacting socially that kind of make could cause you to mess up. Are there things that you still have to be careful for?
Yeah, I think so. I have to be cautious at times, you know, certain public events, places maybe where I know that it might be an event where there's maybe going to be a lot of drinking, and it could potentially based on where I'm at, but you know, maybe weddings or things, but you know, there are always things too that where, usually, you know, I usually have my spouse with me, and she's also a recovering person, so that's always a good thing. Yeah, I mean, certain stressors. I mean, you know, I have found that in my own recovery to like lower my stress level, you know, doing things like other wellness activities to enhance my recovery, physical wellness, you know, getting myself to the gym regularly, eating well, you know, my wife is very aware that like many people, you know, if we realize we haven't eaten for a long time, we get hangry, you know what I mean? And that can maybe make us to become easily intolerant of others. And it when we come a little bit, maybe for the recovering person, becoming intolerant of others and ourselves, maybe ourselves included, can be a really dangerous place. And that might be the kind of mindset that we have to be cautious of, where it's like, okay, I'm feeling intolerant of others, maybe myself included. Maybe it's not a good idea for me to go into a drinking and environment where it's very loose, you know. So it's kind of one where I kind of have to check my head. But certainly there are a lot of things that I can, you know, nurture that level of you know, lower my stress level and increase my level of tolerance of others.
Keith, what about you? Are there things that you have to look out for that might be make it harder for you to stay on the wagon?
Absolutely. So there are some people who will say they never have a desire or an urge to use again. I have not found that to be the case. I still have urges. They're much less frequent than they used to be, and less powerful, but they're still there. You know, in early recovery, Friday night was a massive trigger, you know, not working the next day, like everything was a trigger. And so it was very, very difficult. Like just staying clean or not using was like the main goal. And then as I've been in recovery longer, you know, being in recovery and not using has become the norm. And so that has opened up some things that I can do that I couldn't do in early recovery. Having said that, like I don't mind drinking people, but I don't like being around drunk people. I get uncomfortable when people, you know, change like that. And you know, I have to be mindful of that and of my supports, you know, and when I can go someplace and when I can't. And just kind of, like Michael said, check in with myself because, you know, going to a going away or a retirement party or a wedding, you know, when I'm in a good place, is a lot easier than if I'm in a bad place, mentally. I do have to stay on top of my mental health wellness, you know, so making sure that I'm taking care of myself and doing that self-care stuff is also really important.
Michael talked about living with someone who's also in recovery, and that reminded me of a question I have had. Like some people can be around alcohol and others who use or whatever, but for people in recovery, is that a common thing where they would do better when if they live in a house where the whole house is clean, so to speak? Or is it common to have like one partner who's in recovery and one partner who still keeps like alcohol in the house, or who still has like gummies in the bedside table or something like that?
I don't know the numbers behind it, but I think it is, you know, fairly common to have one person in recovery and another person not. You know, for me, that would be challenging. You know, I don't have alcohol or anything in my house. It was really interesting. My son got put on some ADD medication, and I've had pain meds and stuff in the house in the past, and it's never really been a bother, but like having those ADD meds, which were stimulants in the house, like it was strangely challenging. And I had, you know, 15 plus years of recovery when that was happening. So there's little things like that that I'm just discovering. I would say it is easier if it's not in the house, if both people are not using. That doesn't mean it's a great idea to like get into relationships early in recovery, but that's a whole nother episode, Ezra, that we could go in on that one. But yeah, if it's not around, it's easier if you can find other ways to, you know, socialize and be, you know, with people and it's not a main ingredient, it's easier.
We've been talking about addiction recovery today on Newsmakers, and I'm very grateful for our guests sharing their personal stories and their expertise with us today. Michael Castle is a member of our community who's been in recovery for some time. Michael, what did you say, over 20 years now?
It's 25.
25
25.
years, and has been sharing those experiences with us and some good advice for people who might find themselves in need of a little bit of a self-check there. Michael, thank you very much for sharing your story with us on Newsmakers.
You're welcome.
Keith Lease is with us as well, and Keith, I appreciate you sharing your personal story and your advice for people who find themselves needing some help. Keith is also the program chair for human services at Western Technical College, and has other qualifications as well. He's a former counselor in this area, and Keith, I appreciate your being here with us.
Thanks for having me, and thank you for talking about this subject. I think it's really important.
It's a very important subject, and thanks a lot. We tell you all the time, if you have a suggestion for Newsmakers, all you need to do is let us know what you'd like us to talk about. Let us know what question you want us to get to the bottom to, and that's exactly what happened today. Someone with the Alliance for Heal. Alliance to Heal, which is a local collaborative that works on these kinds of issues, contacted us and encouraged us to do this program today, and we were, of course, happy to oblige. So thanks a lot for the suggestion. And if you have a program that you would like to suggest to us, you can reach out to us anytime. It's newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. Of course, there are a couple of times to hear our show every week. You can hear us Fridays at 10 on the Ideas Network 90.3. We run again Friday night at 7 on NPR News and Music 88.9. And we're always online in your favorite podcasting app. Just search for WPR Newsmakers or go to our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall. Join us again next week for another Newsmakers here on Wisconsin Public Radio.